Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, All the Young Men is a book written by Ruth Coker Burks. At the age of 25, Ruth Coker Burks, a single mother, was visiting a friend in hospital in her native Arkansas. She noticed a door covered in red tarpaulin with the words biohazard written across it. Inside, a young man called Jimmy was dying of AIDS. Outside, nurses drew straws to decide who should enter the room. Such was the fear and stigma around the disease. Ruth walked into the room and comforted the man. He was the first of many young men with AIDS that Ruth would befriend and support at a time when those who contracted the disease were shunned by family, society, government and churches. Ruth Coker Burks joins me now from Arkansas. So Ruth, thanks for being with us on the programme today. The story here is a story of strength, courage and compassion, and also of prejudice. It's very uplifting and also very harrowing in places. Let's just look at the trajectory from then to now. I mean, have people with AIDS always been treated as lesser beings?
Oh, they were treated horribly. I had one patient, Billy. Oh, it was horrible. And this was on into the disease. You know, people knew what it was. And we were at the emergency room in the middle of the night, and they would not let Billy in the emergency room because they said they weren't equipped for an AIDS patient. So they called the police, and a police car showed up to take him to jail. And he had a medical situation. He didn't have a criminal situation, and they knew it.
And like the huge role, I mean, like, you took on this role. Let's just go back to the very beginning. You took on this role because you went to a hospital one day and you realized that there was a kind of a biohazard sign outside the door. And you realized, like, why are these nurses not going in? When you went in for curiosity probably at first. How quickly did you realize this is just insane, a stupid situation?
You know, when I saw them drawing straws, because they were our friends, I would bake cookies and take them up there to them, and we would all eat out of the same cookie bag. And, you know, Bonnie had had 5 years worth of surgery, so we got to be friends with these people, and then they're drawing straws to see who are going in to check on a human being.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't take it.
And were you able to take it, or just how shocked were you when you saw the emaciated, sickly body of the first patient that you saw?
I was really stunned, to be honest with you. Daddy weighed 75 pounds when he died, and he was 6'5", and I was 5 years old. And so, you know, I had seen death before, and I'd seen dying before. And, you know, we kept my grandfather home while he died. But to see this was unbelievable, how emaciated he was. And I couldn't tell him from the sheets. He was so frail.
And every time you came across somebody who had AIDS, and the more you got involved in it, did you realize that the stigma of AIDS, it came with sort of so many weird situations that people have just not wanted to even shake hands, etc., and so much fear that you realized that you had to sort of fight through this?
You know, that was so surprising to me, because I went to what I thought was the best church in town, and they acted so ugly towards AIDS patients. And but that's also where my help was, because that's where I found doctors who would see patients. But I had to, you know, draw the blood myself, and I had to take it in the back door after hours. It was one of those clandestine meeting type things. And it was just unbelievable. I could not get any preacher of any religion to say a prayer over a pile of dirt at the cemetery.
Well, there's so much in that, in just what you've said there. I will get back to that. But just, and the lack of care, the lack of treatment, it was gut-wrenching to you. People shunned by families, shunned by communities. Were you just baffled by all of this? How could people be so stupid and so cruel?
Oh, of course. And I thought, oh, well, I just need to tell the leaders of the town, or the, you know, the leading doctors in town or nurses. I just need to tell them that there's people who are suffering and dying without care, and they will rush to take care of them. And, you know, we're a real big tourist town. We had 6.5 million tourists a year back then. And I didn't want it to spread outside. You know, people would take this home to their families. And so I think a lot of it, the town was embarrassed that I let people know there were gay people in our town, like no one knew. But yeah, it was horrible.
Okay, but I mean, it was obviously a very misinformed time. Was it a very hostile time?
Oh, yes. I had three crosses burned in my yard by KKKs, the Ku Klux Klan. That's a group of people over here that wear white robes and white hoods because they're ashamed to show their faces.
I mean, like, what you were was basically a one-woman army, and you provided food, moral support, testing, social security assistance, a place to live, a place to be buried as well. You became known as the cemetery angel. But I mean, you know, like, you also became known to people in hospitals and to the patients there. So did they call you? Like, quick, we better get Ruth immediately because, you know, she's the only one who can help here. And when they called you, without any, like, I don't know, background in medicine necessarily, did you know what to do?
Well, no, I didn't. I was just a single mother. I, you know, sold real estate. I was trying to make a living for my daughter and me. And I was just doing, you know, we would go to church and I would say, now listen to what the preacher's going to say, because it's going to be good. And, you know, we would go out and take care of the poor and take care of the sick. I had a whole bunch of people, like little old ladies and men we took care of too. And, you know, I just did what needed to be done. No one else was doing it, and somebody had to do it, and I was doing it, so I might as well learn as much as I could and do the right thing.
But like, also, when you mentioned the church there, you were ostracized by your church. And like, you know, as as I have loved you, love one another, until it was put to the test,
right,
of course. And then they didn't give two hoots about you. So, you know, you were basically on your own, even without the church. You know, there was nobody on your side.
No one. Absolutely no one.
And do you think some people had a right to feel, listen, we don't know anything about this yet, because nobody knew how the disease was transmitted at some earlier time? Like, that was a worry for a lot of people. Do you see anything at all in people being afraid? Or was the Rock Hudson situation in October 85, did that sort of...
That was horrible.
Yeah, but that did open doors. Freddie Mercury in this part of the world 5 years later, that opened doors. And Arthur Ashe with a blood transfusion. It made more people understand it all, didn't it?
They did, but it didn't make them any nicer about it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it didn't make them any nicer at all. Rock Hudson called Nancy Reagan over and over and over again while he was dying in Paris to get into the American hospital in Paris because they had something going on that, you know, was a cure or I don't remember what it was. And Nancy Reagan, they'd have Rock Hudson at the White House every chance they got when he still looked good. And when they found out he had AIDS, she would not even answer his phone calls.
What about Clinton, President Clinton? Did you advise President Clinton?
I did. There's a lot of men who would not be alive, and women who would not be alive today, had it not been for President Clinton.
And what was it? Did he call you to the White House, or did you go and meet him?
No, we grew up together. And so I just had his ear and we were pen pals for 8 years. And I would write him every week or two times a week, whatever it took, you know, just letters telling him what was going on and this and that and the other. And he would always write me right back. And, you know, I was invited to be on one of 12 people on the international group for the first White House office conference on HIV and AIDS.
And just getting back, I mean, you live in Arkansas, Hot Springs, Arkansas, young daughter. You didn't have an easy time growing up, did you?
No, I didn't. My mother, daddy was dying when he married my mother, and my mother was a nurse, so they kind of made a business deal that they would get married and she would take care of him, and he would take care of her after he died with a pension. And so, but there was a catch to it. He wanted a baby girl, and he was 60, and she was 40. And so, anyway, she was not equipped to mother. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, clinically, she was diagnosed. I mean, she wasn't a great mom. And like, also, you didn't really have a dad yourself properly, a feckless dad, as you put it at some stage, I think. I don't really care if you don't want me to start praising you too much, but you are a hero. You're a humanitarian. You are a saint, a living saint. There's no question. There's no question about it. I mean, by the way, we're talking to Ruth Coker Burks. All the Young Men is what the book is called. And Ruth, like, you know, you didn't get paid or rewarded. You were demonized. You were vilified. You were banned from medical establishments. You were knocking on doors all the time and none of them opened.
Well, I know, but you just go around to the back door or you go through a window or you wait till somebody comes out that front door and then you go in. And, you know, God was behind me and all of this, and God asked me to go into that room. I truly believe it. And I, you know, I was just doing what, you know, his food was on the floor outside his room with his sandwich and apple juice all over it. I mean, wouldn't you pick, you know, do something or have the nurses pick that up? But, and I just couldn't take it.
Right, but like also, like for instance, like some of the details, like you have the stories of Paul and Billy and Angel and Chip and Todd and Luke and all that in the book, which like some of it's harrowing stuff. One family showed up after their son had died or their brother had died in whatever case, and just to get his belongings. They didn't want to know or see anything else.
Right. Oh my gosh, that was Tim and Jim. And Jim, he was just a country dandy. And you know, I had taken care of him for 2 years and there was no one, no family, nothing. And I would ask him and he'd say, no, there's no one. And when he died, I was at the funeral home filling out the paperwork and they said, the family's downstairs. And I said, what family? Oh, well, there's 11 of them down there. And I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. So I go downstairs and here's 11 people with, you know, two teeth among the whole group of them. And they had come down with a U-Haul to get his things. Mm. And they didn't, they had a two-room apartment. They didn't have any things. Well, they didn't come back for the funeral.
Yeah. Okay. In fact, there's a lot of you being alone in cemeteries with all this kind of thing, all right, yeah, where you're the last person. And as I say earlier, you were shunned and ignored and abused and refused, etc. And you have fed and you have bathed and you had cared for so many people with AIDS. Have you, like, obviously you've advocated because you're talking now about it too and you've written the book, you've researched. Have you educated yourself in a big way? I mean, like, even like, you know, I'm not just talking about the practical assistance of housing and all the stuff that you've done for people, but do you, like, have you learned an awful lot about what should and could be done?
Oh, absolutely. I've learned, you know, there's so many things. And I remember back in the day telling a doctor if they would just pay attention to these AIDS patients, they could learn how people age, because I had people going from being 25 to 85 in a matter of months. Mm. And it was the old age effect that was happening to these young men. But no one wanted to pay any attention to it. They could have learned so much about so many other diseases if they had paid attention to AIDS.
Well, as I say, you're not a health professional. You didn't study as a health practitioner or anything like that. But like, when it came to the end, you arranged funerals, you buried people, you buried under cover of darkness. Did you feel you had to? Did you feel you have to do it or had to do it under cover of darkness?
I did. The first few I did because I was so afraid. And at that time, there wasn't a judge alive that wouldn't have taken my daughter away from me and given her to her father. And so I didn't. This is a well-traveled little road, but luckily people don't pay that much attention to it. But I was so afraid that somebody would know what I was doing and vandalize the cemetery. And so that's why I did it. And then after a while, You know, if you take a plant to a cemetery and you're digging a hole, no one's going to think anything of it except, oh, that's nice. She's planting a plant. Isn't that pretty? And I was burying an AIDS patient.
Wow. Just to get back to the religious stuff, I mean, like many religious authorities publicly, like, you know, up very much against condoms. And in fact, just a few years ago, the BBC had a report about churches saying, you know, that their solution is pray, which is great.
Right.
Fun. Yeah. But like, I mean,
right.
You know, like, has it been said much, or did you actually hear from the pulpit as such that this is God's retribution for a gay lifestyle?
Oh, absolutely. And our vice president passed, Vice President Pence said that condoms were too new of an invention. So he didn't agree with using condoms. But, oh, yeah. And, you know, that's people were so afraid. That's why we have envelopes that you peel off and stick together, or stamps that you peel off and stick to an envelope, because people thought you could get AIDS from an envelope that had been sealed by an AIDS patient, or a stamp that had been put on and gone through the mail. They were that terrified and that uneducated.
You know, I'm just thinking, is the role that you've played in all of this? You were on your own for years doing all of this. Have people finally kind of understood just the important role that you played in all of this?
Right. Well, you know, it's so funny. Since my book came out, I have not gotten one friend request or one message or email from anybody in Hot Springs. I don't live there anymore. But my family came there. They had the first general store there in 1826, but not one word from anybody in Hot Springs since this book has been out.
And would you say Hot Springs is conservative, or would you say Hot Springs, frankly, is quite backward? And like, for instance, you mentioned earlier on finding crosses burning on your lawn at one stage.
Right. And, you know, they thought that was going to scare me. Really, I had a killer on my hands. I had AIDS. I didn't have time for these silly little crosses. And so, you know, I just went about what needed to be done. And I, you know, I had things I had to do. I didn't have time to get into the minutiae that everybody else seemed to be living in. I would just have to walk through it with it stuck to my shoes and try to get it off as quickly as possible.
Yeah. What do you think you offered more than anything? Dignity.
Oh, I gave them dignity, and I found hope for them wherever I could find it. Like, I found the best pharmacist in the whole world, Wendell Workman. And, you know, he gave them hope in a bottle. Because all AZT did was turn their fingernails black, but it gave them hope. And that's all anybody needs in life, is to have just a tiny glimmer of hope.
And what about you yourself with it all? I mean, you never gave in to despair, or you turned someone away because it was too much, did you?
Never.
But it must have
never, got... Never,
never. It must have got pretty heavy sometimes. I mean, like, you must have despaired at some stage.
Oh, of course I did. Of course I did. But, you know, I had been through so much in my life, and I had lived through so much that I couldn't give in then. And I didn't have, there wasn't a time, there wasn't spare time to even think those thoughts, much less get in despair.
Do you know, when you think of local pastors or local nurses or whatever, it wasn't just that you had to go your own way. Did you feel you had to defy them because they were so far behind the curve?
I did. I left them in the dust. Yeah. I just had to move on. And if they weren't going to help these young men, I was going to. And if they weren't going to help me, you know, find housing and food for them, I would go in a dumpster and get the good food that was in there. And, you know, we would eat. And I just had to think of whichever ways that were free for me to get them help.
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned, Rock Hudson, Freddie Mercury, Arthur Ashe, and all those names, like, it's important to move stuff on. What about the 1993 film And the Band Played On? Did that make a big difference?
You know, I don't know that it made a big difference. It just brought it all to light. And that book is the guiding book for HIV and AIDS because I mean, he wrote it and it's so true. The band did play on while everybody was dying. And no one gave a rat's, you know what, about anybody with AIDS.
Yeah, indeed. And like as I say, a young single mom, Hot Springs, Arkansas, with a young daughter. It's a remarkable story. And where are we now with all of this? Where are you now with all of this, Ruth? I mean, what do you do now? And you know, now that the book is out, is that your story told, or is it still being told?
Oh, it's still being told. It's still being told. And, you know, we went back generations with Trump in office. And, you know, now at least Biden has a transgender in his cabinet, and it's a woman. And he has Pete Buttigieg, who is, you know, Mayor Pete, who is the openly gay presidential candidate. He's now our transportation secretary. And the trans are welcome in the military again. So it's opened it all back up. And when Trump was in office, if you got a penny of federal funds from the government, you could not say any sex education at all. Your only response was, can I get AIDS or how can I get it or how can I not get it? Abstinence only was your only answer you could give. And you and I both know that there's a lot of people who are born today because abstinence only doesn't work for birth control. So it's not going to work for HIV.
Are you amazed down through the years, and has it changed at the ability of people to turn a blind eye?
Oh, they can still turn a blind eye. If they couldn't turn a blind eye, Trump wouldn't have been in office. And so, but it's gone back. The HIV infection rate, there was a governor of Florida, Scott, now he's a senator from Florida. He turned back $90 million in grant money for HIV education, training, and medication for people in Florida, and that's where all the big cruise ships go in and out of port. And he turned that money back. Once you get a grant and you don't use it, you never get it again.
Well, I'll tell you, this book is remarkable. It's called All the Young Men, and it is a testament to the power of human compassion right up there at the very top of that list. So, Ruth, congratulations, and thank you so much for talking to us on the program today. It's Ruth Coker Burks, and the book is out now. It's called All the Young Men. It is harrowing, but as I say, a testament to the power of human compassion like no other book you've ever read. Thank you very much, Ruth.
And it's also funny and uplifting.
It
And
is fun.
thank you.
It is funny and uplifting. I know, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to necessarily point to Paul or Billy or Angel or Chip or Todd or Luke, but
Right.
there's fun in there, all right. Yeah, there is.
There's
Absolutely.
a l You can't have drag queens and not have fun, but thank you so much for having me on. It's just been delightful.
Thank you, Ruth. Good luck. Take it easy. Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.